This is 40A&M in 5, a download of 40A&M LLC, recorded at 1800 Eastern on Sunday, November 11th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, Apple issues a transparency report for the first time, while Epic's mandamus petition on surveillance measures is before the Supreme Court. The European Central Bank cuts its benchmark interest rate, while the U.S. jobs report for October turns out to be better than expected. The OECD releases its Science, Technology, and Industry scorecard for 2013. A new study released in the journal Nature provides support for a more robust network to monitor the skies for potential asteroid strikes. Blockbuster Video in the U.S. is set to close its doors. And Ofcom in the U.K. provides comment on expectations for a fully converged audiovisual world. Microsoft, Facebook, and Google all pitch in to reward good hacking. And dignity is non-negotiable, just one of the many great quotes from the FOSI annual conference in Washington, D.C. to give perspective on cyberbullying. And finally, she tweets, she blogs, they score. Violinist Hilary Hahn releases in 27 pieces, introducing us to new pieces and new media all the way to the concert hall. But first, for the first time, Apple has shared details of the data requests that it receives from governments across the globe. Topping the country list, the U.S. made between 1 and 2,000 requests of Apple from the 6 months up to June 30th of this year. According to Apple's report, the most common requests were for data involved in robberies or other crimes or requests from law enforcement for data relating to missing persons, with the most frequent response involving data from an iTunes or iCloud account, such as a name and address. In very rare cases, they are asked to provide access to photos or email, requests that the report says are very carefully considered and only executed under very rare circumstances, according to Apple. The Apple Transparency Report also discussed the fact that the U.S. does not permit it, except under very broad ranges, to disclose the number of national security orders, the number of accounts impacted by the orders, or whether such content as emails was disclosed. Like Facebook, Microsoft, Google, and others before it, Apple strongly opposes the U.S. gag order. The U.K. was second on the country list in the Apple report with 127 requests. Spain, Germany, and Australia rounded out the top five. Last week, the Washington Post reported that the NSA had worked with its British counterpart, GCHQ, to access the private data streams flowing between the networks of Yahoo and Google. The project, referred to as Muscular, is allegedly operated fully on British territory by GCHQ. Late last week, the UK advocacy firm Big Brother Watch published statistics detailing that attitudes regarding the surveillance revelations may be changing in the UK, with 70% of British adults citing that British companies should publish reports on how often they receive requests for customer data from police and security services, with 66% of British adults saying that governments should publish more data about how surveillance powers are used. In related news regarding the scope of surveillance revelations in the U.S., Epic, the Electronic Privacy and Information Center, late last month filed its reply brief with the U.S. Supreme Court in the case In Re Epic. A key component of the case, which was filed by Epic after the revelations provided details regarding the breadth of Dragnet surveillance by the NSA, is that it simply cannot be possible that every phone record in the possession of a telecommunications firm could be relevant under the Patriot Act to an authorized investigation. In its most recent response to Epic's petition, the government argues that the case is not reviewable by the U.S. Supreme Court, in part because it alleges that only the Justice Department and individual telecommunications carriers have standing to seek appellate review of the FISA court order. The Supreme Court could consider the case as early as this month, either voting to hear oral argument by the parties or requesting additional briefs, and render an initial decision on Epic's July mandamus petition as early as the close of November. On Thursday of this past week, the European Central Bank cut its benchmark interest rate to a record low of 0.25%, down from 0.5%. Although the move came as a surprise to many, Bank President Mario Draghi cited that the decision to cut rates was due primarily to a low inflation outlook and a general economic weakness in the Eurozone. The bank's target is to keep inflation just below 2%, which is a level generally seen as healthy. But inflation in the Eurozone has fallen through October to 0.7%. The cut in rates will make it even less expensive for banks in Europe to borrow money, and in turn, it is hoped, prompt greater lending and economic activity from the loans. These moves in Europe came just a day before the release of a very surprising U.S. jobs report. Analysts had previously thought that the impact of the government shutdown in the U.S. would have negatively impacted the statistic, if only for the month of October. But releases showed that there were 204,000 new jobs created for the month, compared to expectations of perhaps 120,000 new non-farm payroll jobs. As a result of the announcement, U.S. stocks began the day higher on Friday, a day after the S&P 500 had its biggest loss in 10 weeks. A loss day that was ironic, given that the day also saw the release of Twitter's IPO, which after some fits and starts of volatile trading, finished at $44.90, up 73% from its offering price. One down note on the unexpectedly good news was the fact that the unemployment rate in the U.S. ticked up to 7.3% in October from 7.2%. In a video reported on by Yahoo Finance, Gene Sperling, director of the President's National Economic Council, said that if we make it clear that there's not going to be another government shutdown, there's not going to be a threat of default, that will take some uncertainty out of the economy. It could help lead to a better holiday shopping season, which is a particularly important time for small businesses. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, just this past week released its Science, Technology, and Industry Scorecard for 2013. Published every 2 years, the scorecard analyzes major trends in innovation in today's global economy. With lackluster growth across much of the globe, promoting new sources of growth through science, technology, and entrepreneurship and innovation has become a global priority for most economies. And the OECD looks to have its scorecard fill an often referenced void for data on how both OECD and non-OECD markets are performing across its 260 science and tech indicators. One of the most striking developments in this edition is the degree to which the emergence of new players and economies has changed the nature of global collaboration. The U.S. continues to be at the center of international research networks, accounting for nearly 15% through 2011 of all collaborations documented in peer-reviewed scientific publications. But as of 2011, China is now the second largest R&D performer after the U.S., followed by Japan, Germany, and Korea. China was also the second largest producer of scientific publications, with nearly 22,000 publications co-authored with U.S.-based institutions from 1998 through 2011. Another key change has been in research mobility. A new indicator tracks the changes in affiliation of scientists who publish in scholarly journals. In this metric, the U.K. is the second most connected economy, with the impact of its scientists who move affiliations across national boundaries nearly 20% higher than other markets where scientists never move abroad. The SDI scorecard is available for review and purchase from the OECD at www.oecd.org. A new study just published in the journal Nature argues that the threat of an asteroid strike, similar to the one that hit Russia earlier this year, is perhaps much higher than previously thought. The international team looked at the past 20 years of data collected by the U.S. government and disparate sensors positioned around the globe. Many of these sensors are in place to detect nuclear weapons tests, but can, according to the BBC, just as easily capture asteroid impact blasts. The result of the study was that roughly 60 asteroids, up to 20 meters in size, had smashed into the Earth's atmosphere, many of them exploding over the ocean or in remote locations, but far more previously than thought. According to the BBC, the asteroid that exploded over Russia in February was estimated to be 19 meters wide, and it hit the atmosphere with enough energy equivalent to 500,000 tons of TNT, causing considerable damage and sending a shockwave twice around the globe. In an interview with the BBC, the lead author of the study, Professor Peter Brown of the University of Western Ontario, said that they'd previously believed that similar strikes would likely only occur every 150 years or so. But the new data suggests that probably every 30 or so years may be likely. Another event in Siberian Russia in 1908 flattened thousands of kilometers of timberland, and these would likely happen only maybe several hundred years. Professor Brown added that having some sort of system that scans the sky almost continuously and looks for these objects is a very worthwhile project. On November 6th, it was announced that the last 300 Blockbuster video rental stores in the U.S. will be closing, resulting in layoffs for nearly 2,800 workers nationally. The once dominant and ever-present Blockbuster brand had been pummeled in recent years by emerging online video outlets, DVD by post, and streaming services. Blockbuster partner Dish Network will also end Blockbuster's DVD by post service in December of this year. Approximately 50 U.S. stores in Alaska and rural Texas will remain open as independent franchises under the Blockbuster brand. Ofcom is the independent regulator and competition authority in the U.K. for communications industries with responsibility for television, radio, telecom, wireless industries, and the postal system. But as part of its role, it also sometimes comments on initiatives at the European Union level in Brussels, which is what it did last month with comments on a green paper, a position paper of the European Commission on, wait for it, expectations for a fully converged audiovisual world. Now, this might seem ho-hum in the grand scheme of communications regulatory initiatives, but the paper and the comments from the European Union regulators reflect the vast changes and myriad new ways of delivering content to users. Although the shuttering of Blockbuster stores in the U.S. was not mentioned in the European Union initiative, these developments in the communications market are precisely the reason for Blockbuster's demise. As Ofcom noted, the globalization of parts of the audiovisual sector is also posing challenges for regulators and markets alike, with the rise and influence of national players perhaps making it difficult for European and national markets to achieve nationally focused broadcasting objectives. In addition, the distinction between push and pull media, the difference between the passively viewed and the interactive, is increasingly less relevant, which requires greater consistency in how regulators potentially address service issues. But in this malaise of change, Ofcom has identified what it sees as four key goals, including promoting effective competition in content markets, supporting viewing and investment in public service content, and more effective approaches to protecting citizens online. But along with vast changes to its key markets in the UK, Ofcom also identified that regulation itself needs to change. This would involve not only ensuring that any framework is flexible enough to avoid becoming obsolete as technology advances, but also avoiding greater and greater complexity for industry and innovation. In addition to its response to the European Commission's Green Paper, Ofcom also published a report on 3G coverage obligations in the UK. The UK's spectrum licenses at 2100 MHz are held by the firms Everything Everywhere, or EE, Hutchison 3G, Telefonica, and Vodafone. Each of these firms are under the requirement from Ofcom to maintain networks capable of delivering mobile broadband data service to an area within which at least 90% of the people in the UK live. The deadline for meeting that obligation was June 30th of this year, and the report details that providers are nearly there. Both the Ofcom response to the European Commission Green Paper and the 3G coverage report are available at the Ofcom website, which is at www.ofcom.org.uk. Microsoft, Google, and Facebook are each now contributing in some way to HackerOne, a volunteer cybersecurity organization, to offer bounties to netizens who seek out web bugs. The HackerOne programs reward users for finding security issues in a selection of software programs that are used by many in powering the internet. The friendly hacker can get a reward for finding an issue and also get an additional bounty for submitting a patch to fix the problem. Monetary rewards can be as much as $5,000 or as low as $300, depending on the software and the problem identified. But in its online literature, HackerOne says that neither it nor any of its judging panel receives any portion of the funding that Microsoft and Facebook is providing to the effort, and also that funding will not give either firm special privileges with regard to the bug-related data found. Google is supplying a member of its staff to sit on the judging panel. On Wednesday and Thursday of this past week, the Family Online Safety Institute, or FOSI, held its annual conference in Washington, D.C. I'd long wanted to attend, and this year, timing provided the opportunity. Not only were the keynote speakers and panel sessions well-organized and debating current issues, but the trade show-style setup of the entrance hall at the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington provided an opportunity for many private and government organizations to spotlight and inform with expertise on online safety. The Connect Safely organization, a not-for-profit that can be found at connectsafely.org, has produced some incredibly concise and helpful literature. Pamphlets with such helpful self-referential titles as A Parent's Guide to Cyberbullying, A Parent's Guide to Instagram, and A Parent's Guide to Cybersecurity. The literature is not only easy to read and informative, but provides practical advice and steps to take in various situations. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's NetSmarts.org tip sheets were also among the most smartly targeted and insightful I've read, on topics as diverse as social networking, cyberbullying, sexting, and tools for better cyber citizenship. These can be found at NetSmarts, NetSmarts.org. And not only is their literature designed for tweens, teens, and parents, but also the NetSmarts workshop, which can be found at the same website, provides an interactive resource from NCMEC designed for children ages 5 through 17, parents and guardians, educators and law enforcement. Much of the conference, as one might expect, focus on activities that take place for many in a far more mobile world than even we might have believed possible a few years ago. In fact, the GSM Association produced a study with Japanese mobile carrier NTT Docomo that cited that 65% of children age 8 to 18 have access to a mobile handset as of the start of 2013, with 20% owning or having use of a smartphone. FOSI partnered with Heart Research to release a study at the conference on the rising trend of teen identity theft, theft not only for potential financial or other gain, but also as a means to bully or intimidate online. The Federal Trade Commission, among its many fact sheets available at ftc.gov/subscribe, has excellent literature on the topic. One of the first day's presenters, Dana Boyd, just completed a book entitled It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Networked Teens, where she detailed her research into how today's teens and tweens have become adept at creating their own private spaces online, right under the surveillance of adults, a behavior that Mrs. Boyd has termed social steganography, using coded or decoyed postings to blunt the effectiveness of known surveillance, essentially hiding in plain sight, by trick or subterfuge, once a type of behavior more common only in totalitarian regimes. One of Ms. Boyd's student subjects also helped her coin another term, where a parent believes that something is up, but in fact nothing is really up. The teen in question refers to that parent's malfunctioning sixth sense as telepathetic. But all great catchphrases aside, some of the most informative and at times thought-provoking commentary was on the subject of cyberbullying, which in the U.S. has been particularly front and center, given the tragic case of Rebecca Sedgwick in Florida. Rosalind Wiseman, the author of Queen Bees, the book on which the movie Mean Girls was based, and the author of the recently released Masterminds and Wingmen on the subject of teenage boys, noted that among cases of cyberbullying, the aggressors have simply lost touch with the fundamental, that dignity is non-negotiable. And this goes not only for the dignity of the victim, but that of his or her friends, family, and others affected by such behavior. Time and again, presenters and speakers at the conference repeated not only this fundamental, but also the notion that building a sense of community and mutual respect among teens is the surest way to combat bullying and related behavior, as a friend or a classmate is often better, in a better position to identify and report that behavior than the victim. An organization taking a decidedly proactive and positive spin on these fundamentals is Project Rocket, whose founders, Rosie and Lucy Thomas, created the Melbourne, Australia-based organization to empower kids through leadership, citizenship, and resilience. Their aim is to promote free expression and acceptance among kids regardless of social labels. Having flown in from Australia to give an energetic and audience-interactive presentation exemplifying these empowerment goals, it was easy to understand why their methods and kid-focused ethic has rapidly developed a following. In addition, Project Rocket recently launched an e-learning initiative, PROC Online, which is available to students in Australia. However, for the benefit of conference attendees, the founders had packaged many of their materials onto thumb drives for purchase. They are fantastic, and I highly recommend for any school or community group looking to develop tools among their young people to address bullying and related behavior on or offline that you take a look at Project Rocket at Project Rocket, all one word, and that's rockit.com.au. Their pitch to the adults was simple. Friends and others who see bullying behavior are the levers for change. And once you successfully pair education with empathy in the minds of young people, you have that social change. Multiple presenters at the conference highlighted that environment, whether it be a school or community or family life, has an undeniable impact on the emergence or prevalence of bullying behavior. And some who engage in this behavior can at times carry it forward through to adulthood. One statistic used at the conference was that 32% of students cited being bullied at some point in school, whereas 35% of adults surveyed cited the experience with bullying in the workplace. In a week where Miami Dolphins football player in the U.S. took the courageous step to speak out against bullying in the locker room, perhaps the statistics are no longer as big a surprise as they once were. Among the numerous companies providing insight at the conference, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Moshi Monsters, and Metaverse Mod Squad among them, FOSI also made a pitch for its new partner website, A Platform for Good, all one word, .org, where users will not only have an avenue for helpful articles, stories, and advice on family online safety issues, but will soon be able to ask questions of the staff and receive bite-sized video answers. As your teachers probably once said, no question is a bad one, particularly when we all might learn from the answers. And for all those listening, remember that Tuesday, February 11th, will be Safer Internet Day 2014. A partnership between the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the European Commission. You can find out more about it at www.saferinternetday.us. Hilary Hahn, the 33-year-old virtuoso violinist from Virginia, has long been one of classical music's brightest stars. From child prodigy and debut with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra at age 11, to first major record deal at age 16, she has released 14 albums and toured the globe. She once said that she had played some solo Bach every day since she was aged 8. But the past few years have also shown her to be one of a select few classical artists to embrace new media in a way that not only has proved to be savvy for marketing purposes, but has also endeared her to fans globally with her quirky personality and self-effacing manner, traits that in the music world are often just as uncommon. Ms. Hahn's musical prowess and a bit of social whirl were both on display earlier this week in Greenwich Village at the Greenwich House Music School, where she debuted her new album entitled In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores. The New York Times described the event as marathon concert, but also part school day and carnival, as in four sets spread across two sessions, all 27 brief pieces that she had commissioned from 27 composers were performed with her recital partner, Corey Smith. Ms. Hahn also arranged to have the scores of these brief pieces be published together in both physical and digital formats to coincide with the album's release. For those who have visited Hilary Hahn's YouTube channel or been a party to her many tweets, video blogs, and Facebook posts, the release of this project on which she's worked for nearly 2 years, the Encores Project, has been much anticipated, discussed, and loved over. Jennifer Higdon, Valentine Silvestroff, Mark Anthony Turnage, and David Del Tredici are just a few of the featured composers, each of whom had other works on display at the Greenwich event last week. Many of the videos and blog posts she and her team makes are more or less conventional, like for instance her interview with dancer Lil Buck, who performed on October 24th with her at the Annenberg Center Gala. Others, as the Tampa Bay Times performing arts critic John Fleming wrote in February, are delightfully loopy, like the very droll one-sided Q&A she conducted one night with a betta fish in her hotel's fish tank. Her Twitter feed is often occupied by notes from her violin case, a quirky set of tweets about her travels told from the perspective of, you guessed it, her violin case. And as she told the Tampa Bay Times, I have a laptop and my phone, that's it. And the internet makes it easy, although sometimes on the road I'll go weeks without a good connection from one hotel to the next, which makes it hard to post videos. In a recent interview with NPR, she characterized the In 27 Pieces project as a CD of desserts, like the cake after a good meal, which is frequently what an encore is. Hahn hopes that by commissioning and performing these shorter pieces from so many up-and-coming composers, she'll introduce many new names and works and perhaps create some new favorites with listeners. Who doesn't like finding a brand new favorite ice cream? In 27 Pieces, the Hilary Hahn Encores is released today on two CDs from Deutsche Grammophon. And that's all we have for you this week. You have been listening to 40 A&M in 5, a production of 40 A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's podcast were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Tampa Bay Times, the BBC, and the OECD. Thank you for joining us again today. 40AM5 will be back with you next Monday, November 18th. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.